That, I think, is a little bit harder to tell because we don't quite know what role he played in terms of getting the conservative justices together. Some have suggested that he had played a significant role because we see Kennedy actually going more liberal in some of the areas he may not have before. So certainly the justices on the conservative wing don't have as strong a voice, as well-read of a voice, right? People are much more likely to read a Scalia opinion than an Alito opinion or a Thomas opinion. We see Alito sort of trying to take up that gavel, though certainly not being as successful as Scalia was. So they did lose a significant voice. They may have also lost a significant sort of coalition builder.
How did Alito try to compensate? I mean, his style, as you pointed out, is not Scalia's style, but he's stepping up his game to try to build coalitions. What did you see from the opinions and the cases that came out of his pen?
I think actually the most obvious version of this is actually a case where the court decided they weren't going to take it. And this is a case out of Washington about pharmacists who have to give out or write prescriptions for the Plan B morning after pill. And we saw the Justice Alito, joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas, actually dissent from the decision not to take the case. And he actually, the first line of this dissent says, "This decision is ominous." And it's a very sort of Scalia-like, maybe exaggeration, clearly pointing out how terrible a decision the court made was.
Well, the court will no doubt have to continue to explore the idea of the conflict of right of conscience and right to medical care and privacy. So where will that ground happen without Scalia's voice then?
That, I think, will be most interesting because really, especially when it comes to the privacy issues and the privacy, whether it's abortion or religious liberty type questions, there's nobody who you could appoint to the court who would be as far to the right as Scalia. So any replacement, and even my guess is if Donald Trump became president, even his replacement wouldn't be as strongly worded on those issues as Scalia is. And so any, I think, appointment would probably be a shift to the left because Scalia, being an originalist, along with Justice Thomas, so severely dislike even the concept of the right to privacy.
SCOTUS blog noted that really only about 10% of the cases would have emerged 5-4, even if Scalia had been there. That's the lowest percentage since at least 2005, when Chief Justice Roberts was confirmed. Did his absence shift the chemistry of the court, allow the center to coalesce, or is this agreeable period something that's been coming on for a while?
I think this just happened to be a down year for the court in terms of really big blockbuster cases. Last year we had gay marriage, affirmative action, and we've had voting rights, and all of these massive cases over the last 2 or 3 years. So it makes sense that in sort of a normal cycle of cases, you might have a year where the number of really highly controversial cases, it's just lower, right? So they did deal with immigration and affirmative action and abortion, but there was maybe 5 or 6 cases this year that really would have had any sort of major significant outcomes or significance with their outcomes. So I'm not sure that necessarily is reflective or a result of the loss of Scalia. What we do see, though, is for next term, the court hasn't picked really many, if any at all, big blockbuster cases. That we can directly tie back to Scalia because they don't want to pick cases that are going to be 4-4 ties. If they don't know that they're going to have a ninth justice or not, really they don't want to sort of put themselves into a position of taking what could be really important issues and then essentially not being able to do anything with them.
Some have suggested that given the political situation, we may not actually see an appointment next year either, that it may take until 2017. What do you think?
I think that's really likely. I don't see Merrick Garland ever being confirmed. I think the Republicans have made their stand, and any regression from that stand, I think, really hurts them politically. Also, it really is going to depend on the Senate. Certainly, whoever is elected president will get to nominate, but if they're working with a Senate of the opposite party, it's still going to be very difficult to confirm anybody. So really, I'm not sure we'll see anybody nominated and confirmed to the Supreme Court until there's a possibility that we won't see that until we have actually a president in the Senate of the same party. So we could go for a couple of years or through the 2018 elections until we see something like that happen.
The political dynamic is that toxic and has broken down that much?
At this point, yes.
You had remarked on Justice Kennedy moving perhaps a little bit more liberal than he was earlier in his career, particularly on the affirmative action case where he had been on the other side of it the first time it appeared to with the court. He is the swing vote, has been for some years. Did his choices show that he was trying to preserve his role as the difference maker? And why do you think he was more liberal this time than before?
I think there's actually a distinct possibility that he is certainly playing the media injustice. And on affirmative action, I think most court observers expected it to go the other way, expected Justice Kennedy to join with the other conservative justices, especially given that Justice Kagan had recused herself from this case. So he really was the swing justice again. It's really unclear, though. We've seen him on social issues always be more towards the left. It's the economic issues that he stays towards the right. But it's not just affirmative action. He also signed on to the majority opinion in the Voting Rights Act case, which had a very different view of diversity and the role of race than this affirmative action case. What we did see, though, the way he wrote the opinion, was it was really clear that this is really about the Texas plan, that this isn't a broad argument for affirmative action or in favor of affirmative action. It's very narrow to that Texas plan. So maybe he thought that that was the best way to move forward, was to say, okay, this plan is okay, and then wait for another case with a plan that he doesn't like to be able to join a majority that would strike down all affirmative action programs.
In crafting opinions to court Justice Kennedy, what do other justices emphasize?
They probably will move towards the middle, right? So they might want to write a more conservative or a more liberal decision. But they would shift more towards the center a little bit in order to court Justice Kennedy's decision. Though when they go to write the opinion, they already know whether Justice Kennedy has voted with them or against them. So Justice Kennedy will read and respond to their drafts in order to keep Justice Kennedy's vote with them or whoever the median justice is at any time. They'll be more responsive during the drafting process to their suggestions than they might be to others who are much more ideologically similar to them.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with ISU Professor of Politics and Government Megan Leonard about the recent close of the session of the U.S. Supreme Court. An article in The Atlantic compares Justice Kennedy to Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. O'Connor voted the GOP in Bush v. Gore. But according to Jeffrey Toobin's book, The Oath, by the end of her career, she was telling friends, it's my party that's destroying America. And that was reflected in some sense in her writing as well for the court. What do you think? Has Kennedy had an O'Connor moment?
I think when it comes to social liberal questions, he has. I think Kennedy sees sort of the writing on the wall when it comes to things like gay rights or abortion rights. He's very much in line and in favor with what might be sort of the prevailing winds in terms of social issues. And that's not to say that everybody agrees with the court granting gay marriage or their abortion decision last week. Certainly, Justice Kennedy sort of sees those forward-looking social issues, and it has not only signed on to them, but of course, with all of the major gay rights decisions, he wrote those opinions. So socially, I would say that is definitely the case. Though when it comes to sort of fiscal issues or powers of government issues, he's still very much in and votes very much in line with the conservatives who vote conservative all of the time on the court.
The larger question, of course, is why he's making this movement. He's 80 years old. Justices Harry Blackmun, John Paul Stevens, and David Souter all moved left as they got older, too. Are those anecdotes enough to identify a trend that older justices often do move left?
certainly not a large enough sample size for us to really get into the data and say much. We do see some shifts in ideology over time. And one of the arguments that actually Linda Greenhouse, who was a writer for the New York Times for a long time on the Supreme Court, made was there's this sort of effect where these people are in Washington, and most of them have moved from, the examples that you use, have moved from somewhere else, especially somewhere that tends to be more conservative, though Justice Kennedy from San Francisco notwithstanding, to Washington, D.C., and they're spending their time around these social elites, around these elites who believe in these or are more likely to believe in these ideas of social equality. And so as people, they shift, which ultimately affects their decision making. We don't have much evidence to say whether that is true or not, but that's one of the arguments that had been made, is that as people they shift, and that ultimately is reflected in their decisions.
If a liberal justice ends up being appointed, who then becomes the center of the court other than Kennedy? How do the roles shift for the other justices?
I think it would depend on how liberal they are, but we might see somebody like Justice Breyer becoming a more median justice. And Justice Breyer is kind of interesting because when it comes to issues of criminal justice, and especially the Fourth and Sixth Amendments, he's actually much more conservative than even some of the conservatives on the court. And so where Kennedy has these liberal issues and conservative issues, we could see something similar with Justice Breyer, maybe. That being said, Justice Breyer is a lot more consistently liberal than Justice Kennedy is consistently conservative.
We've been spending a lot of time talking about the sort of flashpoint cases where the majority and minority are so closely divided. But 48% of the opinions issued this term were unanimous. That is actually about average. If that's the degree of agreement, how is the law being advanced in those ways?
That's a really good point, that one of the most overlooked things about the Supreme Court is that they agree unanimously most of the time. In those cases, I don't want to say they're easier cases or they're cases where the law is more clear, because they can be from any type of law, whether it's bankruptcy law or tort law. They could be from any type of law, but usually what the court is doing there is correcting errors of a lower court. So they're coming in and saying, one circuit disagreed with another circuit and we have to side with one circuit over the other, and this is a clear-cut case of law where this circuit is right. So most of those unanimous cases, or a lot of them, are really the court clarifying so that all of the circuits or all of the and the federal districts are on the same page when it comes to sometimes very small points of law.
Have there been significant effects in the last decade or two from these unanimous cases?
I wouldn't say there's necessarily effects in the law, but one of the things that we actually see the most effect on is how well the Supreme Court acts and functions as an institution. When you're agreeing with your colleagues most of the time, we have a Supreme Court where Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg can be really good friends, where the justices have lunch together, where they get along, where they get everything done, because there is so much agreement amongst the justices. We focus on the contentiousness and we say, oh, that all these 5-4 decisions means the court is no different than Congress, but really they are. They're a very different institution. They're an institution that can get things done because so much of what they do is driven by the agreements that they have with each other.
The Supreme Court is, of course, also composed of human beings who watch TV and listen to the radio and read the paper and pay attention to politics and protest. How is this era and this year of right-wing populism and anger among the economically disenfranchised affecting what the justices do and see?
I think one of the things that they can do is go out and, when they talk to audiences, talk about how they can get along with all of their differences, talk about how they can still be an effective institution. And that might give us or give members of Congress some ideas of how we can overcome differences.
Devoutly to be hoped. Megan Leonard is a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University and an expert on public law. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.